which means that he has a scary face.
Okay.
Next is Al-Ashqar. Al-Ashqar means a person with a red and white face, but the red is dominant over the white. And Ahmar is another, feature that is, he's red, his face is,
okay.
is like a red
redness,
person.
Dominates the color.
Exactly. And the other one is Jadri. Jadri means a person who is suffering from the disease known as smallpox.
Okay.
And the last one is Zakhim al-Hama, meaning that he has like a big head.
Okay.
For example, in this regard, let me just share one narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam, in which he says, يَخْرُجُ إِبْنُ آكِلَةِ الْأَكْبَاتِ مِنَ الْوَادِ الْيَابِسِ The son of Akilatul al-Akbat, we said that this is referring to Hind,
yeah.
the wife of Abu Sufyan. He will come from the dried land, Al-Wad al-Yabis. And then the Imam says that he is Wahshul Waj, he has a scary face, Lakhimul Hama, he has a big head. Biwajhihi Atharun Jadri, he is suffering from smallpox. Idha ra'aytahu hasibtahu a'war. When you see him like a one-eyed man.
Okay.
This is in Kamaluddin, page 651, chapter 57, hadith number 9.
All right.
Now, as I mentioned, these are all the points mentioned in the narrations as the physical features, especially for his face. But it seems that there is only one authentic narration in this regard, and it seems that we may just suffice with this one narration talking about how he looks like, and
okay.
I think it is sufficient for us in recognizing and realizing who Sufyan is.
Well, the features that we have named so far seem to be very, very scary.
Exactly.
And before I just need to take a deep breath, so we will take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes. Like the sun shining behind the clouds, I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We are talking about the Sufyani, and now we were talking about the physical features of Sufyani. Dr. Karimi, before going to the break, told us that he would be having bruised eyes. He's a one-eyed man. He has a scary face, and his skin color is red and white, where redness is dominant over the whiteness, and he is having smallpox, and he has a big head. And one of the narrations from Imam Ali alayhi salam also tells about these features, which are very scary. Now we will say, are these features really in Sufyani or not? Yes, Dr. Karim.
Yeah, many of these features are mentioned in that authentic narration that is quoted by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. The narration is quoted by Kamaluddin, Shaykh As-Sadur in his Kamaluddin, page 651 in chapter 57, hadith number 10. He says that لو رأيت السفياني, when you see سفياني لرأيت أخبث الناس, you see that he is the most wicked of the people. Then the Imam refers to three features for his face: أشقر, أحمر, أزرق. And as I mentioned, it means that he is red and white. The
mm-hmm.
red is dominant over the white.
Yeah.
And Azraq is a person with bruised eyes. So
okay.
these are the features mentioned in this narration of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
Well, these have been the features of Sufyani, wherein we have one of the authentic narrations from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. You said that he said, when you will see him, you will realize that he's more one of the wicked persons, and in fact, the most wicked of the people. And his color is red and white, where redness dominates his skin color, and he has bruised eyes, which again looks like very scary. Anyways, crossing his physical features. Now, what about his religion? Because we had been saying that he will be against, he's an enemy, he's going to carry out genocide. Well, who could do that? Like, is he a Muslim or does he have some other religion?
When it comes to the narrations explaining the religion of Sufyani, there are a couple of narrations in this regard which again may contradict each other. But the point is that none of them has an authentic chain of the narration. Of course, I will share the narrations for the information of the dear listeners. But none of them is authentic, so we cannot come to a certain conclusion about his religion. But there is one certain point, and that is the fact that he is a great enemy to the Shia. There is no doubt about that. And he will try just to attack the lands of the Shia and to massacre the Shia. But referring to the narrations, although none of them are authentic, but just let me share the narrations. There are three groups of narrations about his religion.
Okay.
According to some narrations, he is a Christian.
Okay.
In this regard, we have a narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam. Of course, when I say that from Imam Ali alayhi salam, we are not sure about that because
there's again a chain of narrations which we are going to analyze.
The narration is Mursal.
Yeah.
Mursal narration means that the chain of the narration is not complete. There are some people missing in the chain of the narration.
Narrations, yes. Dr. Karimi, I would want you to read that narration for us after a short break. Sure. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us. Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior, and we have a Dr. Karimi. Dr. Karimi, before going to the break, you were talking about the narration, which talks about the religion of Sufyani.
As I mentioned, the first narration describes Sufyani as a Christian person. This narration, although it is a Mursal narration, it's not an authentic narration, but according to this narration, Imam Ali salam is quoted as saying, وخروج السفياني براية خضراء وصليب من ذهب. This is in مختصر بصائر الدرجات, page 199.
Okay.
Sufyani will have an uprising and he will come with green flag and a golden cross. The narration does not call him a Christian, but when the narration talks about him as a person with a salib, with a cross, a golden cross, it seems at least that he might be a Christian.
A Christian, and that because is why Christians are the ones who wear crosses.
Yeah. Carrying a cross. So this is, one viewpoint and based on one group of the narrations. The second viewpoint based on one narration is that Sufyani, firstly, he's a Muslim, but then he converts to Christianity.
Okay.
We have again another Mursal narration in this regard from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, according to which the Imam has been quoted as saying, وَيَذْهَبُ إِلَى الرُّومِ لِدَفْعِ الْمُلْكِ الْخُرَاسَانِ, to oppose the ruling of Khurasani and to, ruin the kingdom of Khurasani, Sufyani will go to Rome.
Okay.
وَيَرْجِعُ مِنْهَا مُتَنَسْتَرًا, and he will come back from Rome while he has converted to Christianity, meaning that, first of all, he is Muslim, but then after going to Rome, he will convert to Christianity.
Okay.
And the third viewpoint based on some narrations is that, no, he is just a Muslim.
Okay.
For example, according to one narration quoted by Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that, I think I shared this narration before, some people in Al-Wadi al-Yabis go to Sufyani and just reprimand him, damaging Islam. And you see that people, the Muslims, are suffering from different problems. Aren't you going to help your religion?
Yeah.
So it means that he should be Muslim. And that is why these people, they are reprimanding him for damaging the reputation of the religion of Islam and asking him to help the religion of Islam.
Yeah.
Of course, this is a narration in Sunni sources, not in Shia sources. This is in Iqd al-Durar, section 4, chapter 2, page 90.
Okay.
There is also one narration in Shia sources. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, As-Sufyani lam ya'budu Allah qat, wa lam yara Makkah wa lal Madina qat. Sufyani has not worshipped Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at all. He has not seen Mecca and Medina at all. Of course, the narration is weak because of a certain Ali ibn As-Sabbah bin Al-Dahhak in the chain. Of course, the narration does not call him a Muslim. Imam is somehow referring to the fact that he's not a true Muslim.
Yeah,
I mean, we cannot say such a thing about a Christian that he has not seen Mecca and Medina. A Christian is not supposed to see Mecca and Medina.
I just recalled where a prophet tells those people, I don't worship the God mm-hmm. that you worship. Definitely your religion is different than that of mine, referring to Muslims of that
exactly.
time.
So when Imam says that he has not seen Mecca and Medina, meaning that he's a Muslim, but he's not a true Muslim. Otherwise, Imam cannot say for a Jewish person or a Christian person, he had not seen Mecca and Medina. So this
does not make sense.
So he should have been a Muslim, and that is why Imam is talking about some of the negative points about As-Sufyani. And of course, we know that the uprising of Sufyani would be from Sham, the Levant, and which is an Islamic country. This is another indication to claim
that he's a Muslim.
To just reconcile between these contradicting narrations, some people claim that we may come to this conclusion that Sufyani, first of all, is apparently Muslim, but then later he converts to Christianity, maybe because of the fact that he wants to attract the Western countries, the Christian countries, to help him in opposing Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So the conclusion regarding the religion of Sufyani is that there is no authentic narration in this regard. We cannot
say what is his religion.
Exactly. But as I mentioned, the main point about him is that he is a fierce enemy to the Shia.
All right. So he's an enemy, be that a Muslim or non-Muslim, because we have so many Muslims around who are Muslims, but in their actions, they really are not. As Imam says that he has never seen Mecca and Medina and he has never worshipped Allah. So which means that we do have some Muslims around who claim to be Muslims, but their actions say something totally opposite. May Allah make us among the real followers of Imam. Thank you. Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you, dear listeners. Allahumma ajal walika al faraj. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. There are reports that a Palestinian boy aged 14 was shot dead by the Zionist regime forces recently. Omar Lotfi Khomour is the youngest Palestinian to be killed this year, 2023, after he was shot in the head. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Middle East Eye reported a 14-year-old Palestinian boy was killed by the Zionist regime forces near the occupied city of Beit Lahm. The Palestinian Ministry of Health identified the boy as Omar Lotfi Khomour, who was shot in the head and succumbed to his wounds later in hospital. The Zionist regime army has not commented on the killing, but it said its forces entered the Dehesha refugee camp in dawn raids on houses. The Zionist regime army said in a statement, "Suspects threw stones, explosives, and Molotov cocktails at the forces, who responded with riot dispersal means and live fire." No suspects were arrested in the camp, according to the statement. The Zionist regime forces killed 9 Palestinians last week. So far this year, in 2023, 14 Palestinians have been killed, including 3 children. At least 167 were killed last year in the occupied West Bank, the highest death toll since the Second Intifada. The Zionist regime forces conduct near highly search and arrest operations in the West Bank, which often turn deadly. Most of the raids have focused on Nablus and Jenin in recent months, which are home to a growing number of Palestinian resistance fighters. There were further tensions recently after the Zionist regime forces demolished 15 Palestinian-owned shops located at the entrance to the town of Hizma, east of occupied Al-Quds. This was followed by Israeli settlers storming Al-Aqsa Mosque courtyard under the protection of the Zionist regime forces. Palestinian worshippers to Al-Aqsa faced restrictions as a result of the raids, facing stringent checks at key entry points. In Al-Khalil, Palestinian farmers were not allowed to work on their lands after Israeli regime forces raided their allotments. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported Israeli settlers on Monday, January 16th, stole 90 sheep from a Palestinian farmer close to Ain al-Auja community north of the occupied West Bank city of Jericho, according to an attorney. Mahmoud Qawame said that a group of settlers broke into the pastures located between the community and al-Murajat area west of the city, assaulted a girl that was grazing her family's flock of 90 sheep, while her father way away and eventually stole the sheep. The thieves came from the colonial settlement of Kukav HaShahar. Settler attacks against Palestinians are rising. Often they are either aided or protected by the Zionist regime, occupation forces. Israeli settler violence against Palestinians is almost a routine reality in the occupied West Bank and is rarely prosecuted by the Israeli occupation authorities. Settlers' violence includes property and mosque arsons, stone throwing, uprooting of crops and olive trees, attacks on vulnerable homes, among others. There are over 800,000 Israeli settlers living in colonial settlements in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. On the same day, Wafa reported Israeli regime forces on Monday, January 16th, detained 8 Palestinians, mostly minors, from the occupied West Bank districts of Beit Lahm and Al-Quds, according to security sources. They said that Israeli regime forces rounded up 4 Palestinians, including 3 minors, aged 15 and 16, from Kherbet al-Deir area of Tuku town, southeast of Beit Lahm city. During the ensuing confrontations, the gun-toting troops showered local youth with tear gas canisters, causing a number to suffocate. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime police rearrested a former prisoner from the Al-Quds neighborhood of Beit Hanina shortly after releasing him from 28-month-long imprisonment. They also detained 3 other minors, 2 from Al-Quds neighborhood of Silvan and another from the old city of Al-Quds. This came as undercover Israeli regime forces, known as Mustaribin, sneaked their way into Ras Al Amud neighborhood and abducted another minor. Earlier on Monday, January 16th, Israeli regime forces detained at least 15 others in multiple raids across the occupied West Bank. Israeli regime forces frequently raid Palestinian houses almost on a daily basis across the West Bank on the pretext of searching for wanted Palestinians, triggering clashes with residents. These raids, which take place also in areas under the full control of the Palestinian Authority, are conducted with no need for a search warrant wherever and whenever the military chooses, in keeping with its sweeping arbitrary powers. Under Israeli regime military law, army commanders have full executive, legislative, and judicial authority over 3 million Palestinians living in the West Bank. Palestinians have no say in how this authority is exercised. According to the latest figures from Al-Damir, the Palestinian Prisoners Support and Human Rights Association, there are currently 4,700 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli regime prisons and detention centers, including 150 children and 34 female prisoners. This number includes approximately 835 Palestinians placed under administrative detention that allows the detention of Palestinians without charge or trial for renewable intervals ranging between 3 and 6 months, based on undisclosed evidence that even a detainee lawyer is barred from viewing. Mass arrest of Palestinians is nothing new. According to a 2017 report by Al-Damir, over the past 50 years, more than 800,000 Palestinians have been imprisoned or detained by the fabricated regime of Israel. This figure is now believed to be closer to 1 million. This means that about 40 of Palestinian men and boys living under military occupation have been deprived of their freedom. Almost every Palestinian family has suffered the imprisonment of a loved one.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, ways to prevent and treat moral injuries in the family. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the ways to prevent and treat moral injuries in the family in the Islamic lifestyle. Obviously, we know that there are many things that hurts the family formation, that disturbs the family formation. And therefore, we must prevent these things and we must go towards the treatment where we can have a safe, secure, and peaceful family. Therefore, there are some ways, there are some preventions which are being described. There are some ways that are described in the Islam. The very first thing is that we must be obliged to perform all the Islamic rules or live according to the Islamic rules and regulations. We must have the Islamic characteristics in our life. Therefore, this is the first step. The first step is to know about Islam. The first step is to know about the teachings of the Quran and Ahlul Bayt. The first step is to get to know what guidance did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put in the Quran for us, which can take us towards the perfection. That is the first way. The second way is to have a good connection with the family members, with our parents, with our brothers and sisters, with our children, with the wife. This bond which is between the family members, if it is a firm bond, then it will make a good family, a strong family, a peaceful and secure family. So therefore, in order to have the secure family, we must follow the teachings of Islam, number one. Number two, we must have a good relation, a firm bond with our family members so that we are close to each other and we trust each other, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the ways to prevent and treat moral injuries in the family. We described two ways. Now, the third way of preventing and treating the moral injuries in the family is to think before speak. It is recommended in many traditions of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that you must think before you speak. Generally, when we speak, when we talk to our family members, maybe there is an argument, there is a discussion. In that argument, we don't think what we're going to say. And we try to say things without thinking before it, without thinking about the consequences of such things. Therefore, it is necessary to think before we speak, to think about the consequences of what we're going to say. What are the effects? Maybe it will hurt my wife, maybe it hurt the spouse, and obviously this, the wordings that I use, they might not forget these wordings which I will say. Therefore, it is necessary to think before we speak. The fourth way is to avoid friendship that results in having a bad language in the family, having a bad character, which makes me a bad person, which makes me a person whom people do not trust. So therefore, I must avoid such friendship. And the last but not least is to make a jury whenever there is a dispute in the family. Generally, we have seen, like in the past, people used to go to their parents to solve the issues. When there was an argument between the husband and wife, which they couldn't resolve, they used to go to their parents, they used to go to some elder people or the elders of the family, and they used to take their issues there and they used to consult them before going to the court or having a lawsuit. But in today's world, unfortunately, whenever there is a dispute, the first solution that comes in the mind is to go to the court or have a lawsuit, which should be the last option, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iran's domestic production capacities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As you know, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dubs every Iranian calendar year with a theme which fits to the conditions of the time. The leader named this year as the year of production, knowledge-based, job-creating. The themes of the year are chosen by Ayatollah Khamenei to motivate the officials and the people towards putting the internal potential capacities into effect to push the country on the course of progress. Thus, we have prepared a series to briefly review Iran's capacities in various fields. As for the first episode of this series, you will be hearing Iran's capacities in the field of agriculture. Stay tuned, please. Agriculture is believed to be the engine of economic growth and development. Food health and security of a country are directly related to agricultural products. Agriculture is one of the fundamental bases of sustainable economy. According to these three aspects of the engine of economic growth, food health and security, and the base of sustainable economy, developed countries concentrate seriously on agriculture. A review of economic development in different parts of the world shows that the developed nations, based on relative privileges, have made the best use of domestic economic capacities and existing opportunities in the global arena toward growth, development, increase of per capita income, and improvement of other indexes of development. A brief look at the record of economic growth in developed countries reveals that they have reached this growth mainly through agricultural growth. The significance of agriculture in the growth of economy and the capacities of the country have been stressed in the statements of Ayatollah Khamenei. Iran is a four-season country with a broad variety of climates. The country's exceptional geographical situation, variety of climates, and the big number of workforce in villages and production centers are all the gifts that God has granted to this country. Precious products such as saffron, pistachio, and barberry belong mainly to Iran. As for barberry, nearly all the barberry of the world, about 98%, is produced in Iran. Saffron, as a strategic product, almost enjoys the same status. The Islamic Republic of Iran has made broad investments in production of important crops such as wheat, oilseeds, beet, cotton, horticulture, and also the industries of animal husbandry such as milk, meat, chicken, eggs, seafood, etc. This helped the country reduce notable bulk of its imports in the field of agriculture. For instance, the Islamic Republic produces approximately 14 million tons of wheat annually, which is a major step toward self-sufficiency in this strategic domain. In addition, Iran exports some of its agricultural products to other countries, including neighboring nations. Thus, in an 8-month period, nearly 5.5 million tons of agricultural products were exported with an income of over $3 billion. The officials of the sect maintain that these revenues can be increased manifold. Investment in agriculture has made the Islamic Republic immune in the field of food security. This became highly significant, especially during the period of former U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure, which was an absolute failure, according to the statements of the American officials. With nearly 9% of the GDP, 7.17% of employment, and 9.5% of non-oil exports, the agriculture sector enjoys an important status in the economy of the country. Having 37 million hectares of potential harvestable farms, 120 million livestock centers, 84.8 million hectares of pastures, 14.3 million hectares of forest and rich genetic resources, 2,700 kilometers of maritime borders in the north and south of the country, and scientific and expertise forces, Iran can turn into a hub and role model for agricultural development in the region and beyond. This can help the government decrease its dependence on oil revenues. Although big steps have been taken in the field of agriculture in Iran, there are many capacities which have been left unheeded. Many capacities have been neglected, which can cause a leap in agriculture. One of these capacities is the fishery of high waters. Enjoying nearly 3,000 kilometers of sea border has made the country a good center of fish farming and other aquatics, or the breeds, which can be raised in warm and salt water. Moreover, according to the statistics, there are 10 million hectares of dry farms in Iran, which can be used for production of 5 strategic crops. Studies show that over 2.5 million tons of wheat, over 1 million tons of barley, more than 2.5 tons of fodder products, and more than 800,000 tons of oil seeds can be harvested in these farms. Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
الله اکبر.
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. Men have priority over women in capitalism. Therefore, you can see that women are abused in two ways in capitalism. One is in the workplace itself. This is an important point. Now, this woman who said she had lived in the West, she is probably well aware of these points. You can also find out about this in books and in places where there is information on general subjects. In many Western countries right now, the wages women receive are lower than what men receive for the same type of work. So they assign the same work that a man does to a woman and pay her less money because she is weaker, because she is more vulnerable. That is how it is. This is a form of abuse. One of the reasons why the issue of women's freedom was raised in the 19th century and later in the 20th century, but mostly in the 19th century, was to pull women out of their homes and push them into factories where they could be used and given lower wages.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to add something here. The same thing happened with regard to the freedom of black people in the America during American Civil War in 1860 AD. That is almost 160 years ago. In those civil wars that were going on for several years between the North and the South, over 1 million people were killed. In the aftermath of those wars, the issue of the freedom of slaves, the freedom of black slaves, was raised. There was agriculture in the South, and there were industries in the North. The South was the center of slaves. The slaves were mostly in the South, where they were used for farming. The people in the North needed cheap labor. They needed these black people. The controversy over freeing the slaves was initiated by the people in the North. If you have read the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was written about 200 years ago, it is about the same period in that time. They encouraged the black people to run away, and they would take them to the other side. Why? So that they could free them? No, it was because they needed cheap labor, cheap workers. It is the same method of deception used by the civilized gentleman in the West when dealing with various issues. There are many other such examples and similar cases. Therefore, they have truly harmed women in this case when they brought her into the workplace so that they could lower their expenses and pay her less money.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The heads of the main EU institutions defended the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy during a debate in the European Parliament on Wednesday. They insisted that sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro, is the only way to thwart Russia. Most lawmakers agree, but not all.
We see militarization, we see escalation. We are not really seeing a call for peace. We assume it will be the people who suffer the cost of sanctions.
Interest rates continue to rise in the eurozone and inflation remains extremely high. Sanctions against Moscow and the rapid move away from Russia's energy are the main reasons.
The cost of the living crisis affecting our European citizens unfortunately persists, and we are therefore concerned that the European Council conclusions fail to prioritise the support for our citizens.
Experts warn public support in the EU for the seemingly never-ending cash flow to Ukraine will eventually wane if the war persists, resulting in political consequences.
There can be a kind of danger which is already looming, that very populistic parties, they can use this as an argument to say, look, this is something we have to cater for our own needs first, and then we have to see what's going to happen in Ukraine.
In an unprecedented departure from diplomacy on Wednesday, the European Council President Charles Michel accused authorities in Iran of operating a, quote, brutal regime. He says more sanctions against Tehran will be announced on Monday. Some lawmakers oppose the policy.
The EU and its partners never stop violating international law, going above multilateral institutions like the UN with their own parallel systems, including punishing millions of people around the world through our authoritarian unilateral sanction regime.
By insisting that rioters in Iran are peaceful protesters and by attempting to directly implicate the Islamic Republic in the Ukraine war, impartial analysts say the EU is being opportunistic, suggesting the new sanctions are trumped up and politically motivated. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
From hero to zero, and claps don't pay the bills. Some of the chants by nurses here and across the country on strike again in a dispute with government over not just pay, but patient safety. Emma has been a nurse for more than three decades.
For a long time, we've felt we haven't been able to give the care we want to give because we're so pressed for time, resources, simply just numbers on the ground. So I think for a long time, we've wanted things to change, and it's come to the point where this something has to change, and this is really our only option. Nothing else is working.
The reason behind that, more than 10 years of underfunding and neglect.
Across the country, the health service has been facing what's been described as an intolerable and unbearable strain due to a combination of COVID, the seasonal flu, and staff shortages, with some patients having to wait up to 24 hours for a bed inside a hospital such as this one.
That plus a record 7 million patients on the NHS waiting list, described as a national scandal. The Royal College of Nursing Union demanded a 19% pay rise when they first went on strike last year, but has since cut that in half. Yet a deal is yet to be reached. The Health Secretary, James Cleverly, says the strikes put patients' lives at risk. Last week, the government introduced legislation that, if passed, will enable employers to sue unions and fire employees if they refuse to work on strike days.
Rather than talking about the pay negotiation, talking about safer staffing and the safety and quality of care that we're giving up and down the country in our hospitals, the government have gone down this sort of anti-strike, anti-trade union route. So, once again, so it's interesting to talk about safe staffing levels on a strike day, but what about the other 365 days in the year when we have not enough nurses on duty, not enough doctors, not enough physiotherapists, cancellations of operations and delayed chemotherapy? What about those days? What about safer staffing on a normal NHS day?
The UK has been hit by months of public sector strikes from rail to mail, all of whom say they're in for the long haul. In the weeks ahead, more strikes are planned by nurses, paramedics, and ambulance drivers. With the Royal College of Nursing warning it'll be their biggest walkout yet if pay talks with the government do not progress soon. Saeed Purza, London.
Gaza, the symbol of resistance. This is the title of the conference held in Tehran. Attended by Iranian officials and members of Palestinian resistance groups, the event seeks to shed light on Palestinian suffering under more than seven decades of Israeli occupation, with Gaza bearing the title of an icon for the struggle for freedom.
Gaza, the 360 square kilometer, besieged over 17 years maybe, and with this dire situation, the people over there were managed to steadfast, to confront the continuous aggressions and offensive from the Israeli forces against our civilians, against our common people in Gaza.
The event is held on the anniversary of the 22-day resistance in the Gaza Strip in late 2008 and early 2009, where Palestinians resisted Israel's military offensive.
Today was the day that in Iran we remember the resistance of the Palestinian people in Gaza district after the invasion of the Israeli troops in 2008. On that year, the Israeli troops invaded oppressed people of the Palestinian in Gaza district. And in Iran, every year we remember that.
This year's edition of the annual conference seeks to recognize late Iranian General Qasem Soleimani's role in strengthening the resistance axis in Palestine.
When we talk about freedom, when we talk about resistance, when we talk about Palestine, you cannot miss the name of Shahid Soleimani. Shahid Soleimani is a big icon for us in Palestine and resistance movement to defend our own legitimate right. Shahid Soleimani was a big brother to us.
General Soleimani was killed along with his fellow comrades in January 2020 near Baghdad International Airport in a drone strike launched by the U.S. The Iranian military commander spearheaded major operations in Syria and Iraq that led to the defeat of Daesh and recapturing of key areas from the terror group.
People here say General Soleimani was a key element in the resistance front, who had plans to liberate Palestine from the Israeli occupation. They say this was a major reason why the U.S. assassinated him. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former EU lawmaker Pierre Antonio Panzeri was among those arrested by Belgian police last month as part of a probe into a cash-for-favour scheme allegedly involving Qatar and Morocco. He has just signed a deal with prosecutors to name names in return for a reduced sentence. On Tuesday, during a debate in the European Parliament on the scandal, the EU itself was accused of corruptly targeting some of its own member states.
Nota bene.
No peace without justice. Whose secretary has been arrested for corruption? This organization was financed by the EU, France and Germany. What a coincidence, because this very organization focused on attacking Poland.
Belgian police have recovered more than €1.5 million in cash following dozens of raids. So far, the scandal mainly involves members of the S&D political grouping in the European Parliament.
Since the accusations emerged in December, we in the Socialists and Democrats group have been working intensively to try and implement reforms to combat corruption. We have to ensure accountability, transparency and integrity.
Sitting Greek MEP Eva Kaili is among four currently behind bars awaiting trial. Lawmakers are demanding that an EU-wide ethics body is established. Aside from the Parliament scandal, each year millions of euro go unaccounted for from the EU budget. This as ordinary citizens struggle to make ends meet.
It's a serious source of concern, and we also see that there is very little progress made on poverty and social exclusion, which remains at very high level in the EU.
Some lawmakers say the EU is showing a great deal of hypocrisy, given that so much is said here about rule of law problems elsewhere. Sources tell us Belgian police will almost certainly be making more arrests in the coming days as part of the European Parliament corruption probe. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Yes,
For over a millennium, Florence, known as the cradle of Renaissance, has been a global icon of beauty, being the third largest tourist destination in Italy after Rome and Venice. Florence, a stunning, vibrant city with a storied and well-preserved history, attracts every year around 60 million tourists from across the world. However, starting from the last decade of the 20th century, its city center has been eyed by big investment groups interested in making profits through the acquisition of local real estate assets. As a result, living costs in the oldest part of Florence went dramatically up, forcing a high number of residents to sell their apartments.
This situation has been going on for a number of years now. Florentines who used to live in the city centre found living costs unsustainable and opted to move to the suburbs. Their former houses had been rented to wealthy tourists, and investment companies have made billions in profits.
Throughout the years, smaller landlords in Florence have been aggressively targeted by large corporate investors. For those investors, housing has turned into a key factor for the management of global capital funds. As a result, the new housing market has led to excessively high rents, widespread displacement, as well as the dismantling of local communities and social bonds. A referendum called Let's Save Florence has been recently launched in the Tuscan city in an attempt to protect the citizens from the real estate bubble and the speculation which have distorted the local housing market. Many hundreds of residents have supported the initiative so far.
It's a shame that Florentines have been forced to leave the city center. It's their city and it's been taken away from them. There have been significant repercussions on Florence's social cohesion, as back in the old days, the city center used to be a meeting point for young and old people. It's really bad for our city's sense of community.
The center of Florence has been placed in the hands of large investment funds, and everything is made to support tourism today. Small shops, typical shops, have been forced to shut down. Just a few thousand Florentines still live in the city center these days. Florence has 360,000 inhabitants today, 200,000 less compared to 20 years ago.
Florence is not the only Italian city where large investment groups have been buying properties in historic areas. Rome, Venice, and Milan have also been the target of corporate landlords. In 2021, in Berlin, Germany, more than a million Berliners supported a campaign to expropriate companies holding 3,000 or more apartments. Italian cities should maybe resort to a similar measure to try to keep local residents in the city center. Max Civili, Florence.
We attended a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Health in Sana'a, where it was declared that the Saudi-imposed blockade is causing a national health crisis by preventing entry of medicines and equipment for kidney failure patients. In the absence of dialysis treatment, approximately 5,000 patients on dialysis are at risk of dying, according to the health ministry.
The Saudi-led coalition targeted the health and medical sector from the very beginning of the war by directly destroying medical facilities, centers, hospitals, and medicine warehouses, and by imposing a blockade on every aspect of life through this siege that is being backed by America in order to control the country's health system.
Khalid Ahmed is one of the patients on dialysis, who is currently getting treatment at a Thota hospital. He said the lack of supplies has prevented him and other patients from receiving the required number of dialysis treatments per week.
We cannot eat much because we are only receiving two dialysis treatments a week instead of the required three treatments. As a result, we can only eat a bare minimum food.
But getting the required three treatments per week for Gayed and the other 5,000 patients like him is a near impossible task these days. This mixed solution, which is used to operate the dialysis machine, is in very short supply. There's only enough